Pisces Friday. Darren, welcome to Nonstop Rock Talk. Thank you for joining me on the show tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
As I was reading your bio that was sent over to me, I was quite taken by your story. I'm not sure how much you'd like to elaborate, but I understand you had a serious car accident that was life-altering that led you on your journey to write and record your latest release, Lifting the Curse.
Well, yeah, it was, it was life-altering for sure. I mean, serious. I kind of where I become uncomfortable is, we all have that when we feel like you don't have to look very far to see somebody has it worse, right? So I'm still here to complain about it. So it could have been way worse. But the aftermath, and particularly, I don't know about other states and countries and everything else, but I know in Ontario, again, without getting into too many details because of, obviously legalities and stuff, but it's not an easy recovery when if you get injured, even if it's not like real serious or real bad. I was at the doctor today, this is like several years later, for something related to that, and the psychological effects of the whole aftermath dealing with the litigation and insurance and all that is just it basically knocked me out of commission for a few years. So while I couldn't do the heavy rock shows, or at least not many of them, I couldn't perform to that same level anymore for a little while, and I really had to rethink things. I started turning one of my projects into an acoustic project, and it's that desire, like a non-negotiable need to create, right? If you're a musician or a songwriter, you want to keep going. And sorry, this is a long answer, but
no, it's perfect, man. Make it as long as you like.
Yeah, well, basically, I started working on just writing, recording, and I was kind of going, man, some of these songs don't fit, with Creeping Beauty or something. One of my other bands, other projects that were kind of all on hiatus anyway because of my situation, and so yeah, it just kind of turned into this instrumental thing, and I had a really good time doing it. It was very therapeutic, and that's why I call it Lifting the Curse, because it seemed like, throughout the entire summer that I was working on this, it just felt like everything was, that light at the end of the tunnel, like this is something really cool happening, and get that spark back. And it really started with one song, where the song called "The Song Won't Get Played on the Radio," which you can tell by the title, it was just kind of me being goofy. Yeah. And it sounded it was like a goth B-52s thing or something. It was very weird. And I thought, all right, I'm going to make a video for this. I've never done that before myself. Made a video, put out the song, and then the response was actually pretty good. So, I'm just going to keep going, and eventually I'm going to make an entire CD and set a deadline and followed through, and surprisingly I was doing it for me, but the response has actually been really good.
On that song, on "The Song Won't Get Played on the Radio," "This Song Won't Get Played on the Radio," I kind of got, like, you mentioned the B-52s, I kind of got like that Frankie and Annette Beach vibe, those old 60s movies. And that was the kind of vibe I got from it.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was thinking too. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember having what's the name of the band? Oh, it's going to drive me nuts now because I know instrumental band.
Like from back in that time?
Yeah.
It's right on the tip of my tongue.
It's horrible. I know exactly, and it's just not coming to me.
No.
What's that?
The Ventures. Okay, yeah.
That's it. And I had a record of The Ventures. Of course, by that point, I was probably listening to Alice Cooper and stuff too, but I remember listening to that. I just loved it. And it's funny, all these years later, I hadn't even given it a second thought, and it's like, some of that kind of seeps in. Yeah. When you're creating music, you just never know. Like, people will say, well, who's your influence? And it's like, pretty much anything you listen to, it's there. yeah, I mean, there's songs on there that I feel there's you know, some metal, but it's not, the whole thing is just not, if anybody's looking for a shred fest, it's definitely not that, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I agree with that, because, and I can't remember, I have that in here, because, and we will talk about that, because especially there was one tune that I listened to, and I thought, you know what, you played melodic, where, like, sometimes a guy would just play, certain guitar players would just play the crap out of it, over top of it, and you really kind of held back on it, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
So tell me a bit about the recording of the album. Was this kind of done over a long period of time, or was it like once you started, then you just kept going?
Well, I think it, like the first couple of songs were done kind of at my own pace, because they weren't really, I knew I was going to release them and I was going to make videos for them and do it that way. But at that point, I hadn't really decided that I was making a full album. But once I did decide that, it was recorded over the period of the summer. And I, you know, I set a deadline for myself. And, you know, and my summer is kind of my busy season, and I had a lot of things going on, but I just really kind of dove into it, you know, even if it was at night or whenever I had to or whenever I had time. And, you know, to say that doesn't mean that it was like, you know, painful and annoying and frustrating. It wasn't anything like that. It was all good. You also have to figure, some people will do that and they put so much pressure on themselves. Like I had the self-discipline, but I also realized that, you know, we're human beings, right? And there's that time where you go, you know what? Right, just I'm not feeling it. So you need to take a day or a week or whatever it is and come back to it. But I did find myself kind of, you know, when I wasn't working on the music, I was thinking about it, like, I can't wait to get to working on mixing some drums or whatever it was I was working on next. It was something I really looked forward to doing.
So you tracked pretty well all the drums yourself, except for, was it Something I Said, which were done by Emily Dolan Davies. I'm kind of curious about that process. Like, usually, I mean, if you're in a band, you can, you know, lay down a bed track with the guy playing guitar, he does the drums. Was that challenging for you?
I guess it had its challenges, but for the most part, not too much. I mean, some of it was played, you know, organically with real playing, and then a lot of it was edited and right. You know, I don't hesitate to say program, because it was still done probably like a little more old school than that. Mainly out of necessity, because I didn't really know how to do it any more efficiently. So, but I'm not an especially good drummer, but I took drum lessons when I was a kid. I mean, I'm a big drummer fan, and so I knew what I needed in terms of the sound in the songs. And by sound, I don't necessarily mean like the snare tone or something. I mean like the groove, the feel. And the one song that Emily plays on, which is just fantastic, was, I mean, as you can tell, it's a different groove than everything else. And I couldn't get it. I had the song. It was kind of a Prince sounding song in a way, to me anyway. There's a little bit of,
it's fun. It's kind of fun.
It's kind of a throwback. Look at it.
Yeah. It's kind of like, it's like kind of funky. Like it's a cool, I mean, it's a cool sounding, yeah, like track, and it's funk. Different from everything else.
Oh yeah. You know, like kind of funk rock, you know, there's some heavy grooves in there and heavy riffing and yeah. And I just, there was no way that was coming out of me. I knew what I wanted, but I just couldn't get that type of feel. And Emily has a thing called Stem Club. And if you look her up, I think Emily Drums is one website, is one way to find her. Right. You can use her, she has drum tracks, she has stems up there that you can use for free. Cool. Like, it's amazing. So you can go in and, use her drums and know, but you just have to give her credit. And then the idea is when you actually want her to drum on your tracks, you know, start to finish and with proper, you know, editing, whatever you want, then obviously that's a paid service. But yeah, I can't say enough good about working with her. She's total professional and has a great YouTube channel, and she's a lot of fun. She's a really nice person.
Yeah, and I was actually going to ask you about that. Was it because you didn't feel like you could get the feel of it? And sure enough, that was, I guess I was kind of right on that. So,
and you know, it kind of is and it is. It was sort of almost one of these things that happened, because I was writing that song, but I wasn't actively pursuing it for the album because I couldn't get really the feel. And I have another song that didn't make it on. I went as far as, you know, even paying to have it mastered, and I just went, no, I'm not. I, you know, if you're the boss, you know, you're doing everything, you have to have some sort of a sense of like, no, this is it's not about my ego and my, like, I made this, and you have to kind of go, no, this is going to drag it down.
Yeah.
And it was like a last minute thing. I was working on this with Emily, and I went, I have to put this on the album. And so I asked her, she was totally cool about it. And, you know, there it is. And it's kind of one of my favorites because it is so different.
Yeah. Yeah. It really caught my attention when I put it. I was like, oh, this is different from everything else. And this is awesome. And it's kind of, I mean, this song Won't Get Played on the Radio is different as well. It's got that different vibe. But
yeah, that's kind of why I sandwiched them in the middle of the, you know, the CD is sort of like, and that's something I love about the album. Like now everything is so digital and, you know, that's cool. I don't fight the technology and the future, you know, that's okay. But I do appreciate the album, you know, the art of that. You know, if you go and get Batter of Hell and you put it on, you know what it's supposed to, where it's supposed to start and the journey it takes you on, you know, or, I mean, pick any classic album, you know that's what it's supposed to sound like.
That's right.
And I love that about an artist, because it's sort of a snap, like a snapshot of the time period that they're in, right? And, I have no problem with singles and that sort of thing, but I'm definitely working on a new album too.
Oh, fantastic.
I had so much fun with this one. I'm like, yeah, I have to do this. I, you know,
keep doing that's it. Great. I think talking about those classic albums, the 70s was a time in music where a band could push the limits a little bit and evolve and change and be diverse, where they, you know, like one song, it didn't flow as much into the next. It didn't all sound the same. You were able to be more of an artist then.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, I remember listening growing up to like Kiss record, where, you know, they had Death and God of Thunder on the same album. And it didn't matter. It was all an experience. And I don't know where that got lost or why, but it seems like now everything is like micro genres of everything, and everything has to have a brand. And it's, I don't know. I like to, that's why people make mixtapes, you know, they make playlists, not mixtapes, but you know what
they
I mean?
Make Yeah, and I mean, Destroyer is a perfect example of that, because not only had Bath and you had God of Thunder, Great Expectations with the orchestration, and you know, like, and then Flaming Youth and Shout It Out Loud, and it was just, you couldn't wait to hear the next song to hear what was going to be coming out of the speakers, right? It was,
I mean, Bob Ezrin was genius, right?
Exactly.
And it was an experience, like it took you on a ride. And I think that's kind of what I miss. I want an experience. I want the roller coaster. I want the slow song, the mid tempo, the really fast one. You know, the whole thing on the same album. Like it, you know.
That's right.
Because you're not feeling the same way all the time, right? I don't know why anybody would want to listen to the exact same song over and over again. We have different. Music is something that connects us and you relate to, and we have all these emotions, and music can bring that out or enhance it or change it, you know. And I think that's something that should be explored, not just, you know, redirected into something like real generic, you know.
Yeah, exactly. In the 80s, I think that's kind of where it started, where the labels wanted. You know, once the label gets involved and they're in charge of what you're doing, more or less, that's where it kind of, the creativity, they kind of want to pigeonhole you into one type of sound because they can sell records. Whereas the good thing now, and I've had this conversation with a couple artists, is that if you're doing it yourself, it's a lot easier to be an artist and put your music forward and do it your way, as opposed to having someone say, well, no, that's not how we need to do it, right?
Yeah, we're not underestimating the listener, you know. Okay. Like the idea of just having everything real, again, to use the word generic or safe, you know, this is the safe way to make money or to sell a product, which they would look at as the artist, whereas a real artist is about creating something and you know, connecting and relating with people, and yeah, you can do all kinds of different things when you don't have anybody telling you not to.
Well, yeah, exactly. Now, as I listen to the album, and you're talking about moods and whatnot, I mean, there are many on the album. There's many mood altering arrangements. Notational Witchery comes to mind. It's kind of somewhat dark, but when it comes, and I want to ask you, when it comes to naming an instrumental song, it's got to be somewhat of a challenge. Like, especially with that song, like, tell me, was there a basis to, listen to the song, listen to it back and go, you know what, this is kind of what I'm feeling, this is what I'm thinking?
Kind of, yeah. Usually, my whole life I've written songs, and most of the time I write lyrics too. So that part is not new, but the fact that, yeah, you're still naming a song that, you know, there's no real reason for it.
That's right. There's no hook. There's no chorus, right?
Yeah, there's no reason for anybody else anyway. Like, there could be for me. And it's just really kind of a cool question because, in this case, if you read most of the titles and you look at the artwork and stuff, it's like a concept album, even though you don't really have any proof of that because there are no lyrics. But to me, when I listen to it again, it's a whole piece, you know, and it feels like a concept, and it was certainly a concept in my mind when I was putting it together. So, you know, like Notational Witchery, sometimes in a little bit of a, you know, me being a smart ass and then kind of having a sense of humor in that particular case, there were a couple of parts that I played that are probably a little bit bizarre for a guitar player. And I'm thinking, you know, if I were trying to learn this, I'd be going, What is he doing? What kind of tuning is he using? Because I pulled out some kind of bizarre little tricks. And so I thought that was kind of funny, you know, like a little bit of a guitar player joke, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, the whole thing has kind of, I often, when people say, what genre is it? What do you call your music? And I say, well, it's instrumental witch rock. And cool. It's like, what is that? I'm like, I don't know, what is anything, right? It's
yeah.
There's names for all these subgenres, but to me, I spent a lot of time in nature and trying to heal, and I felt that kind of, you know, without getting real weird or anything, but it felt, I don't know what the word is. How would I put this? Yeah, I kind of hesitate to. I'm not sure how to describe it, but
that's okay.
Yeah, I wish I could come up with a better
analogy. And it's funny because, you know, I'm kind of putting you on the spot here too, because these are probably a question that you may or may have not thought that I would ask.
It's all right.
I was kind of, as I was listening to it, it came in my head. I'm like, how? I'm looking at these titles and I'm going, okay, well, how do you talk about instrumental music? All you have is a title. And we could talk about, okay, well, this part and this bar here, but
I
kind of wanted to go a little bit, you know, like kind of deeper into your thoughts on what the titles were. So.
Yeah.
So I do apologize if I put you on the spot.
No, not at all. That's why I'm here. And in fact, it's cool. I just wish I had a better explanation for that, because I'm thinking to myself, you know, I wish I could find a way to explain that, because it I'll probably be asked again at some point. I have to think about that.
Okay, well, that's cool. Moving on to... And this is a cool title. The Earth is B flat.
Yeah.
I read that and I was like, that is clever.
Yeah. I think, again, me being a smart ass, right? And of course, I think there's only one actual true B flat note chord played in the entire song, which, again, is just me being funny.
I like that.
But yeah, you know, it just sounded cool, and I was kind of like watching too much X-Files, I think, and, you know, if you watch the video, you can kind of tell.
Well, to me, I mean, it kind of reminded me of something that would have been played in a scene in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, which was the second one.
In which, sorry?
Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, you know, they go to hell and they meet the Grim Reaper. And I kind of listened to it, and I was like, you know what? That would have been perfect in that movie. I mean, that would have been perfect.
I haven't seen that in so many years.
Yeah, it's funny, because I watched it. I bought a double pack of the two of them, so I watched it last summer. And kind of brought back some cool memories. With that said as well, the ending chimes it was kind of Trans-Siberian Orchestra is what kind of I got out of that.
I hadn't thought about that.
Which I thought was very cool, because I kind of I like that sort of thing as well, and it's almost like a thought out, orchestrated type of thing for me as a listener, I love hearing that kind of stuff. And it's funny, us mentioning Bob Ezrin, he was classic for doing stuff like that as well.
Oh, yeah. And of course, you know, when I say about like being influenced, for example, it's funny because you can be influenced by not just, you know, guitar players, for example, because I'm a guitar player, but I'm influenced by other songwriters, producers, movies, life in general, right? It's just all kinds of things kind of seep into your subconscious, I guess. And what comes out is often a surprise, and you can try to manipulate it to be what you want it to be. And I'm sure there's a science to that. And there are people who write hit songs all the time for, you know, pop and country artists and stuff, which, you know, and I'm not dissing that, that's a whole other thing, but, you know, they base that on, you know, chord changes and harmonies and certain lyrics and a tempo and all that stuff. But when you're an artist and you're just kind of following the song, following, you know, what you're coming up with, you can often be really surprised.
Yeah.
And when other people like yourself have these references, I kind of go, wow, that's cool. I never even thought about that.
Yeah. And sometimes I feel bad because I'm like, someone told me that sometimes I listen differently than a lot of other people, but I think when I'm listening to something, I'm really focused on everything. I'm not just hearing, you know, like the vocal. I'm hearing like the bass, the guitar, like, and if something stands out to me, I always like to point that out and say, hey, you know what, that kind of sounds like this. And that's just me. I'm kind of a music listening geek, I guess you would call it.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm saying the same thing. And, you know, when I'm coming up with stuff, a lot of times I hear the song, like everything in my head kind of simultaneously before I even start recording it.
Yeah.
And of course, that often will change. Sometimes by accident, you know, you hit a weird note or you just start noodling around and go, oh, that's neat. I'm going to take that wherever it goes and see what happens. But I still kind of hear it all in my head, which is amazing for somebody who can't do simple math in his head. But I can hear the bass and I can hear the harmony and I can hear all that. And, I don't know. It just happens. And so when I'm listening to music, it's the same thing. I always hear new things and songs I've heard, you know, 100 times. I still get a lot of value out of it. I think that's a magical thing about music. It's, you know, you can listen to something for 20 years or more and still, and you know, it can be nostalgic, of course, but I'm not talking about that. I mean, just the actual value of something that you really enjoy. And,
yeah. I love it when I rediscover something that, say, I listened to 20 years ago and didn't really love it then. And then all of a sudden, it just stands out to me. And I'm like, how did I miss that? What?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah. That happens to me, too. And in fact, I often say that it's been a lot of years, like probably since I was a teenager, that I would refer to something as sucking.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like, you know, when I hear something and I don't like it, it's usually because I just don't relate to it. And there were things I didn't relate to when I was younger that now I go, wow, that was, even if I still don't particularly like it, I respect it. And I go, wow, okay, I get it now, you know. So music, there's nothing wrong with not relating to something, you know,
that's
true. Okay. But that's true. Thinking that everything sucks that you don't like is it's pretty narrow, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, as a teenager, a song like, for instance, like "Love Bites" by Def Leppard, when
right.
that song came out, I hated it. I absolutely hated it. But I didn't get the texture of what was going on within the music with the guitar parts, and I was just listening to it as a song, but as I became a better musician myself, the more I listened to it, whether you like the song or not, it's just there was more to it than I had actually thought.
Yeah.
With the guitars and Mutt Lange's production and whatnot.
And yeah,
that's just
absolutely.
An example. There's many songs like that I would say, well, that song friggin' sucks. You know?
Oh, yeah. And there are whole genres of music and whole bands that, you know, I just didn't. A lot of times, even when I was younger, it's not that I hated it. It was like not on my radar. You know, I didn't want to. It was quite a period of time where, you know, the Beatles were just, I had zero interest. It was like that was my parents' music or something, or I didn't want to hear it. And now I can listen to it and go, okay. I get it.
I was the same. I was like, I always loved the Stones, but didn't get the Beatles. And then a few years ago, I got, I bought Rubber Soul on vinyl, the reissue, and I just kept listening to it over and over again. And I just, I mean, it's one of my favorite albums now, but
it's amazing, right?
Ago. Yeah. It's so funny how that, you transition, right? As you grow and whatever.
Oh yeah. And sometimes there's a real, skill in simplicity too. And, you know, when I, you know, often I'd have a guitar student or something who would be like, oh, I already know how to play AC/DC stuff. That's easy. I need to do something more difficult or whatever. I'm like, well, you know, there are a lot of bands out there who play AC/DC and sound, you know, not very good. And the reason you know, people always go on the singer, right? They always let the singer. But it's like, no, the AC/DC were and are really tight, you know, really syncopated. There's a tightness to that music. And if you're playing those chords, okay, everybody can play a G and a D and all that, but if you're sloppy, you're not getting it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that, I mean, that AC/DC is one example, but there are a lot of things that as you get older and get more experience and a better musician, that you learn to use your ears more than just learning to use your fingers or your voice, you know what I mean? You have to actually hear what's going on and the timing. And I find as my ear gets better, I hear more problems in my own playing, like, you know, timing and stuff. Like, I got to clean that up, you know?
Yeah. And you know what's funny? Like, because Smoke on the Water is like the most famous song that every kid, so many kids played on guitar.
And usually wrong.
Exactly.
I know I did.
And the thing was, you learned years later, like, that he actually finger picked it.
Yeah.
And that's what gave it that actual natural sound that it had. I mean, of course, the organ and the bass, I mean, it's really, it layers itself and it just builds up, which is so cool. But Blackmore actually finger picked it, which gave it that sound, which I always thought was so cool. When I finally learned that that's how he played it.
Yeah, it was kind of a snappy, I mean, when I first learned to play it, it was like, the typical kid, you know, on one string playing the E, just playing notes. But I mean, as a kid, the fact that I could play that and still recognize what song it was is really cool. And that's a good lesson too, because I think that's what he was going for. You know, he wanted something, a real simple, memorable rock riff, and it's, you know, become what the
most, it's iconic, right?
Yeah, the most famous rock riff of all time, and really, so he accomplished what he was setting out to do, for sure.
Exactly, and it's funny because as a kid, first you start off just picking the notes, but then when you evolve a little bit more, you just want to power chord the crap out of it and make it sound as, you know, like as dirty and heavy as you can.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and that goes back to what I was saying about AC/DC too, and a lot of those classic bands. As our gear has gotten, has evolved, a lot of times we're playing with, you know, as guitar players, we have a ridiculous amount of gain and distortion and all this, because now we can do it and still hear the notes. I mean, back in the, you know, early days of distortion, it wasn't like that.
No.
But when you're playing AC/DC with, like, you know, Slayer distortion, once again, you're not getting it, you know. you're not listening to what it's actually doing, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, the distortion on AC/DC isn't like you said, it's not Slayer distortion. It's distortion, but it's kind of, I think it's clean. It's cleaner than that, right?
Especially, it's like amp distortion.
Album, right? Yeah, amp distortion, exactly.
Yeah.
So let's go to Music in the Murder House. Now, I love that title as well. It's kind of bold and it's kind of creepy, but funny thing is I kind of get it. As you listen to the music, the title matches the effect of that music. I like the moving heavy riff. It's an interesting piece because the riff is heavy, yet your soloing portion to me seems bright and actually happy sounding.
Yeah.
And I loved that. I was like, this heavy riff, and then I wonder what he's going to do. And then all of a sudden, this guitar solo comes in, and I'm like, that's interesting. That is a really cool take on how you did it. And this might be a funny question to you, and this goes back to the basis of maybe how you named the song. But now, what is going on in the murder house is my question. It's not the question of the murder. It's how it's being brought forth. Is it like an 80s slasher type thing, or is it more of like a shock porn thing? It's like, there's a murder going on in this house, but like, what? And I know that's kind of a sick question, but as I was listening to it, I was kind of thinking that somehow my mind kind of went demented and went out in left field.
Yeah. And you know, the only real answer I have for that is that it kind of, I think, if I had to really think, I was had anything in mind, it's almost more like Amityville Horror, you know, where there was a real murder, and then And then, of course, it sort of got strange afterwards. And then people are still to this day questioning, you know, what was a hoax, what was real. And so I think that's what it was, because the heavy part is like it's sort of a reminder that, you know, there were real murders and real people, and it was tragic. But yeah, the solo, like to me, that's kind of like the chorus to me, is that kind of happier arpeggiated thing that's melodic. And yeah, but if you want something to sound heavy and you have something that's a little bit lighter, the heavier stuff sounds heavier, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of where the dynamic I was going for. Like,
and I loved it. I love
it. Could be a little darker.
It kind of it threw me for a loop. It kind of threw me off, because I'm like, that is unexpected. And you know, I always love those guitar, like, for an instrumental album, when you hear the solo and it's memorable and you can remember what, like Joe Satriani, I thought on Surfing with the Alien, there was a couple songs on that were perfect, where you could actually sing that melody he was playing.
Yeah, and I mean, he's got a new video just came out.
Oh, does he?
On YouTube, yeah, it's really cool.
And I mean, checked it.
It's Satch, you know. I don't want to say he hasn't evolved. Of course, he has, but he hasn't changed what he does and what you love about him, right?
So, yeah,
that's very cool.
Like I remember seeing Satch Boogie when it came out on video on the Power Hour,
and thinking,
this is really bizarre that they're playing an instrumental artist on the Power Hour, because they hardly ever did that, right?
No. Well, there wasn't too many people really doing it either.
No, just like the Shrapnel guys kind of thing, you know, like, but that was...
Oh, yeah, the Shredders, yeah.
Right, but there was no one like Joe Satriani, and then all of a sudden this, like, really amazing, cool instrumental song, there's a video for it, and you're just like, what the hell is that? Wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I don't know if you remember, but he had a video out where that he was actually singing it.
Really?
I remember that? Yeah.
No. Where he was actually singing?
Yeah, that was really early on. Like he had hair on and he was singing.
Big Bad Moon.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, that was on the second album. Yeah, that was a cool album too. There was he sang a bit on that album.
Yeah.
And that was a cool tune too.
I was hesitant for the longest time. I mean, it's not really why I hadn't put out an instrumental album. I mean, a lot of it is this time. There's only so many hours a day when you have several bands going on at the same time. You know, your priorities are all over the place, and you don't really want to go, I'm going to put out an instrumental album now. But part of the other thing was that it's flat out fear, really. Like, the thought that I'm going to put out an instrumental album and people are going to go, well, you know, he's no John 5 or he's no Steve Vai or what's he trying to be, Joe Satriani, you know, that those things kind of creep into your mind. And to me, I'm like, I don't even fit. Like I'm in fact, and I don't feel like this is a bad thing. I'm quite proud of the fact that this album doesn't fall into... It sits somewhere in between all that. It's not, doesn't sound anything like any of those other artists, and they don't sound anything like each other. So that's kind of cool. Yeah, I mean, like I said, if somebody's expecting a shred fest, then there's a little bit of guitar wankering in there for sure, but it's really not what it's about. It's, you know, and even the songs for that, and I don't think there's anything that goes much over 3 minutes.
Yeah, and I liked that. That was kind of cool, because I was like, oh, we're on to the next song already. This is, okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to be, as a songwriter, that's just not what I would normally do. I wouldn't write a 12-minute, you know, song. Not that I'm against that. I mean, it's fine if that's what you do. But for me, I've never been comfortable with it. It's just never been my thing. I've never felt like that's what I need to say. I don't have to write long songs. I prefer something a little snappier. And the only difference here is I didn't have any vocals, so I had to you know, still keep it interesting for the time that there would be, you know, some vocals going on. And I found, like, some of the songs are real obvious where, okay, verse, chorus, you can kind of tell where those parts would be. Mm-hmm. Some of them, you throw some other stuff in there because you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, you get to Tails and Entrails. That's kind of dark as well.
It's kind of a dark title.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And the chords ring out nicely. And I love the changes. To me, it's kind of theatrical. But this is where what I love about your playing is you don't go over the top all the time. And we have touched on that. You let the music breathe, which allows the song to be very listener friendly. It's kind of like, to me, it's kind of like in language where someone with a high IQ, when they speak to you, they come down to your level and they don't make you feel inadequate. If that makes sense, it's kind of like with guitar playing, like there's some guys that like they're so over the top that the normal listener can't understand it. And it's not, and they just turn it off
or it's just not interesting because you're giving them everything Well, guitar players also have this thing of not shutting up because we don't have to, you know what I mean? Like if you're a singer, you have to take a breath.
That's
why you have melodies and phrasing and that. Guitar players can just go endlessly. And so sometimes you have to go, okay, you know, what would I do if I were singing this? And pull back a bit.
That's right.
Yeah, and it makes for more listenable music. Sometimes.
And you know what? And as I was listening to it, I started thinking about Marty Friedman.
Oh, yeah.
And he was that type, he's that type of player, especially on like, not on the first Megadeth album he did, because I mean, that was Shred Fest, but as Megadeth kind of went from Countdown to Extinction to Euthanasia, Cryptic Writings, and Risk, he would use melody in the guitar to match the vocal, and he really, his playing became like very less thrash. It was really interesting to listen to, and it fit the songs, and that's what, and as I was listening to your work on this, that's kind of what I thought.
Yeah, you're the second person to say that, actually. I think that's pretty interesting. I think it's a good point because in thrash, for a while, like a lot of music, certain things were starting to sound the same. You know, the guitar solos kind of, they all seemed like they started the same and they went off on the same kind of, you know, just fast descending lick or something.
And, yeah.
You know, it's okay, but if you can do something more interesting and more, I don't know, unique, then why not? And, you know, of course, I think it's all come, you know, a long way from those days. But, Freddie Freeman, I mean, it's a whole different level there.
Of Marty Friedman? Well,
yeah.
I mean, he's...
Yeah, well, those guys that we talk about, they're the gods. They're for a reason, you know.
and that's true. He just, I mean, Marty, that the guitar sound itself, no matter what he was doing, it always sounded huge as well. It was just this, you know, it was like it resonated well, and you'd be just like, oh, that was so cool. No matter what it was, it's just he's that type of player as well, and. I mean, us mentioning Joe Satriani, that's the same type of thing.
Yeah.
Now, a little bit about your background. In your bio, you had played with Nicholas Walsh in Famous Underground?
Yeah, well, we still do. The band's been, on a little bit of a hiatus for a while, but even though it doesn't seem like there's much going on, we're not dormant. There's new music, and so, yeah, that's pretty exciting. I can't really give you any details that would have to come from Nick, but I know, again, there's new music and, you know, hopefully that will be seen and heard soon.
That's cool. Kevin Gale, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, the guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
The last 2 years, on and off, I've actually been working on Kevin's autobiography. writing that with him.
Oh, nice. Cool.
So when I saw the Slick Talks with Nick Walsh and saw that, and I was like, oh, that's cool. Okay, well, we'll have to definitely have to talk about that because, I mean, I'm a huge Slick Talks fan. And I love Nick, and the guy's a powerhouse vocalist, and he's just amazing.
Well, and writer and guitar player, musician. Most people don't even know that. I mean, not only one of the most talented people I've played with, but one of the most talented people I know or seen. I mean, more than a powerhouse.
I'm not going to say too much about what's going to be in the book, but I mean, there's a segment in the book of us talking about Nick going in and recording the song Midnight Grind on Doing the Nasty. And
we played that, actually.
Yeah, and I guess Nick just hours and hours of screaming and just killed it. So I have a lot of respect for that. So you guys did that song. That's a great tune.
Yeah. That was really cool. That was a lot of fun. We played that a couple of times anyway. I think we played it.
That is amazing.
It's pretty neat to play stuff like that. Like, occasionally we'll play Hell of a Time or something like that. And then it's like, that's the dude singing.
Yeah, I know.
Once again, in the video, we're playing it together, so it's pretty cool. That is always kind of a kick.
Yes, that very, very expensive video.
I get to hear some fun stories about the video too. So it was fun.
It was a lot of money, apparently, but
yeah.
On some
those was the golden age of MTV and stuff, right? I mean, that's people were the excess that. On videos and wardrobe and all these things that I can't speak for that video, but I mean, just in general, it was getting, pretty much crazy that, bands were spending so much money, or the labels were spending the money, but really the bands were
eventually. Yeah. Exactly. Indirectly, they were spending it.
And then, MTV were at the point where they were so powerful, it didn't, they could just not play it.
I know, it's crazy. You could make or break a band, right?
Yeah. Well, and on top of it, the band, this is when people talk about, Spotify and YouTube and stuff, and the content, and we always talk as artists, like, oh, we're getting, ripped off or whatever. And when you think about that era, the artists that were in these videos, they don't get any performance. The videos were played in syndication and everything, and nobody gets anything from that. Whereas if they were on a sitcom or something, they'd get something. It's still their likeness. They're the stars of the video. Mm-hmm. They put out all this money, and absolutely. A band went from playing a club to, an arena within, a month, because that's the power of the video. All of a sudden they couldn't walk down the street. But there was so much control,
Imagine how deflated you would be if, say, the label spends like $300,000, $400,000 on a video and MTV only plays it once.
And
your album dies because of that, right?
Yeah, or said, no, we're not playing this, right. And I mean, this stuff happened,
Happened. That's right.
And now sometimes, every now and then I'll see something pop up on YouTube or something, a video that I haven't seen, years, and go, oh, wow, I forgot all about this, And then there were some that they never even played. Like, I mean, for us, much music, but there were ones that, some of my favorite bands, I'll see videos and go, I didn't even know there was a video for this song.
Much music was so limited because you had the power hour, but it was once a week.
Oh, and it kind of got down to like the power 30.
The power 30,
And then they were playing the same things they were playing during the day anyway. So, I had my frustrations with that too, as a fan, but there was a period where it was just absolute heaven to have videos playing all the time. And it was just 12 hours, live, and then, you know, and then repeated. And I had the VHS, you know, recorder.
I did the same. I was the exact same. It was, and then I remember going to my buddy's place, and he'd be like, "Did you see the Power Hour yesterday?" I was like, "No." He's like, "Well, I recorded it, so let's watch it." And then he'd like one video, say it was like the Vinnie Vincent invasion, and then he'd make me listen to it. He'd make me watch it like five times in a row. Isn't that a great song? Isn't that a great song? It is a great song, but it's not going to be anymore for me because you're ruined.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or it was the case of making sure that your friends liked it because they now they knew it, you know,
right? Yeah. And I always loved it. I always, if I had somebody I knew that had a satellite dish, and it'd be like, "You got to put on MTV." And then you turn on MTV and there'd be all these videos that we would never see in Canada. Like, you know, because in the early 90s, like, it was those bands, late 80s, early 90s, those bands were so huge that they had become mainstream. So now they're playing so much of it on regular programming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember, I think it was Quiet Riot. And then I remember they probably come off Illinois. I think it was like the first, you know, heavy metal number one hit on Billboard charts or something like that. But I remember really clearly seeing that music video at school, like in music class. The teacher brought in, you know, the video thing and played some music videos, and that was one of them. And of course, you know, it's hard rock. I'm a kid, and I'm like, this is it. I love this. So I go home, first thing I do is I call up the local radio station, and I'm like, "Can you play Quiet Riot?" And I still remember clearly the guy going, "Nope." And I'm like, "Well, why not?" And he's like, "Never played Quiet Riot, never will." And you know the ending to this story, because they had to play. They played Quiet Riot a lot eventually.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was
It could be funny. I mean, for a fan of that music, sometimes it could be very disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
And because it wasn't like, it was so looked upon by so many like adult people and whatnot. And then even like some of your peers that you went to school with, they'd be like, "Oh, you listen to that metal stuff and that's horrible," and this and that. And you're like, "Oh, whatever, man."
Yeah. I only remember that when Motley Crue came and they had Whitesnake opening.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, and at that time, Whitesnake were just becoming huge on, you know, Much Music and that. But they were becoming a huge band. They were probably bigger than Motley Crue at the time, at least in terms of, you know, mainstream popularity.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the people who didn't like Motley Crue were going to that concert, and, you know, from school. And I still remember how the next day all of those people had Motley Crue shirts on, and now they were all Motley Crue fans. And I'm like, come on.
Yeah, exactly.
This, you know, that's not yours, that's mine. You know, that kind of feeling when you're, you know.
And that was exactly... You totally nailed it. That was exactly it. That was when you were, like, this big fan, and then the people that were, like, buying into the trend, and they started liking, you're like, "Wait a second, what are you doing? Like, that is mine. Like, you're not in my books, you're not cool enough to be buying those t-shirts now and listening to that, because a week ago you didn't like it."
Yeah, but I guess, you know, they're ultimately, that's the goal in a way, you know. You and certainly want the growth and the sales and the fans, but yeah, you become a little protective of something that you know, you're really attached to, right?
And it's funny, I have a buddy who like, he's like me. He loves like all that music still. And he always jokes, he goes, "You know, some guy at work came to me and I was listening to this band. And the guy said to me, he said, "Oh, that band, I used to listen to them." My buddy's, he's like such a smart ass. He always goes, "What do you mean you used to listen to them? Like, you don't like them anymore now? So, you know, it's not cool, it's not trendy, so you don't like it?" But he's just a smart ass that way. And always that always stuck out in my head, because I always found that to be the funniest thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a good point, you know, like, I mean, there could be a lot of reasons legitimately. Yeah. Some people just, their taste change over the years.
Exactly.
And that's fine. Like, I don't know. I think I'm not one of these people, you know, I enjoy the nostalgia sometimes. And it's not, I mean, I still listen to music that I listened to when I was younger, and it's still, I don't listen to it because I want to feel like I'm 16 again. I just like the music.
Yeah, I'm the same.
But that's okay. It doesn't, like I always say, people say, oh, you know, the 80s ruled or this, or like, well, I like to go visit once in a while, but I don't live there. You know, I still have music to make, and I still listen to new bands that are coming out and new music that, and sometimes stuff that I've, like we said before, that somehow slipped past me, you know.
Yeah, well, but I don't, and that's just it.
I'm just not stuck in the spandex, you know.
That's right. I have a lot of vinyl of 80s stuff, but I also listen to other stuff, you know, like I was at the gym today, and on the TV, I looked, and there was Hailstorm.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, I got headphones on. So I kind of watched the video. I took the headphones on, but I couldn't really hear the song. So then I put the headphones back on, and I went on Amazon Music, and I looked the song up, and I was like, I probably listened to that song 3 times in a row, because I was like, oh, that's a wicked song. That was, you know what I mean? So bands like that, I love. So, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's still, and I always kind of am skeptical or suspicious of people who say, oh, there's no good music, you know, being made anymore. And I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of good music being made.
You just,
you're probably not invested enough to look for it. You know, if you're listening to nothing but mainstream stuff, even that is not to say that it's bad, but you're certainly not going to get the variation or the spectrum of what's really out there.
And
maybe never did, really.
Yeah,
you know, that's catering to the masses, and that's okay. But
yeah, and I've always been kind of, and it sounds like you are as well, kind of the guy who, it's like, I don't care if it's popular. It doesn't matter to me. It's more, does it move me? Does it, you know, do something for me? And so I like it.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, again, it has to do something to move you. And you know, there's so many possible emotions that can come from music. So,
yeah.
As long as it can be any of them, as long as it does something, you know, it's too boring. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's boring music. It just might be boring to you because, again, you're not relating to it. And
yeah, exactly. You know. I mean, I'm going to see Blackberry Smoke on Saturday, hopefully, as long as doesn't get canceled.
And I've been hearing that name a lot.
Yeah, and that's not the norm for, you know, it's not, they're not an 80s band. They're not a heavy band. They're just a great rock and roll band.
Yeah. So, and really, that's great. And myself, I listen probably to less metal. And I mean, I like some pretty heavy stuff, but as far as even my own playing, a lot of it is just, I always hesitate to use the word pop because people think, you know, I don't know, pop being whatever it is today. But when I say that, I mean like April Wine, you know, bands that were popular were played on the radio, but they actually played instruments, you know. And
yeah,
that was rock.
Going back in the 80s, I mean, the hard rock hair bands became pop more or less because they were popular, right?
Yeah, and even, I mean, okay, Shout at the Devil or Diary of Madness, those types of things. Yeah, there was certainly some metal meanings, and anybody who says, well, that's not metal because it doesn't sound like, you know, Flesh God Apocalypse or something like that. Well, okay, but back then, that was metal. I mean, you can't say that Black Sabbath wasn't metal because they don't sound as heavy as band today, it was that where it came from. But some of it wasn't, you know, like Poison, and that's no disrespect, because I, you know, Poison wrote some great songs, but that was still pop, you know.
Yeah.
It was pop rock, you know. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I mean, they sold a lot of albums, and they did what they did, and they had a big fan base. I mean, they still have a big fan base, so.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes I've been guilty of going, oh, what are they doing? But, you know, at the same time, when I really think about it, I enjoyed their music a lot of time. You know, it's been a lot of time listening to them and watching those videos, because they were super entertaining. And, you know, and I kind of feel the same about The Darkness now. Like, I love The Darkness. I listen to the music, the great guitar playing, and, you know, and they have videos that are just over the top, and, you know, they're not taking themselves too seriously. They're having a great time, and, you know, it's rock and roll. What's to complain about, right? It's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's entertaining. And it's funny, mentioning, going back to Poison there for a second. It's so funny because I think it was the VH1 Behind the Music of Poison, Bobby Dahl makes a statement, and he says something along the lines of, I didn't set out to be a musician, I set out to be a rock star. And I always thought that was like the funniest thing, because, you know, Poison always got slagged for not being a great musical band. But he affirmed it right there, and he's like, yeah, well, I wanted to be a rock star.
Yeah, well, and that's what they did, right?
Exactly, so.
Yeah, and although it's funny, because I look at, like, I don't know, I guess I'm somewhere in the middle, because I really don't care about being a rock star. And I also know that I'm not, you know, Steve Vai, but I still... The music is the most important thing to me, as long as I can be artistic and creative, and that's kind of where I land on it. I don't think so. Today's rock star is not exactly the same as it was in the 80s anyway.
No, I mean,
you know?
Yeah, and that is so true.
Now they're tweeting, you know.
I can't remember who told me this. I think it was Steve West from Danger Danger, quite possibly. It was actually in an interview. He was on a podcast with the lead singer from Train, and he said something about, I think it might have been Fall Out Boy going on their bus, and he's like, all right, guys, you guys ready to party? Like, let's have a good time. And they're all on their cell phones, and they're just sitting there, not really, you know, like, he's like, what the hell's going on here, man? Like, back in my day, this is not what we were doing.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, and I'm kind of conflicted, because, you know, sometimes people get real, you know, artists get real pissed off because people have their phones, and I get it. I mean, I've been there, you know, but I also sort of think, well, you know, if somebody's paying to come into your show and they want to look at their phone, they paid their ticket, you know, like, sucks, and it's a little frustrating, but, you know.
Thing I find funny is that the cigarette lighters are no more, and it's the phone going up in the air during the slow song. That I just can't get used to that. I want to see the cigarette lighters again.
Yeah, it is odd, but that's
that's just where we've gone, right?
Yeah, so. It's true.
Darren, I have taken up quite a bit of your time, and I appreciate you doing this interview, man.
Oh, no trouble. Been fun.
Yes, it was, and I mean, we had some rock talk, which was, I mean, that's the premise of the show, as well as talking about yourself and what you're doing. But I mean, getting to talk about music, just bands in general, is always, I always love doing that. So,
I'm up for this. You know, want to talk again, more rock talk, just let me know.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely, yeah. I'd love to have you on again, and we can just, you know. I actually have a couple guys that have been on the show and have said the same thing to me. They're like, I want to come back, man. We got to do that again.
Yeah, it's fun.
So I will, I'll get in touch with you, and we'll do it again for sure.
Perfect.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and the best of luck with the album. And,
awesome. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And you have yourself a fantastic evening.
All right. You too, man.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye.